Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who do or don't go to church, and for those that are disillusioned. If you want to contact us, by the way, our email address is ogc@accessradio.biz, and biz is spelt B-I-Z. We're also on Facebook as well now, at Off Grid Christianity. Today's guest, apart from being a speaker and an author, is an abbess. What is an abbess? What is Spring Forest, a monastic community in North Carolina even, all about? How has growing up in poverty and leaving home when a junior in high school affected, encouraged and propelled her in her faith today? Gives me great pleasure to welcome to Off Grid Christianity, Elaine Heath. Elaine, thank you for joining us today. I must try and get North Carolina to be said correctly. So,
thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, for those of us don't, well, I know where North Carolina is. I've had the pleasure of driving through it. But for those that don't, whereabouts is North Carolina, please?
It's on the east coast of the United States. We're famous for the Outer Banks. You might have heard of the Outer Banks.
No.
There was a movie made with Richard Gere years ago. Now the name of the movie slipped my mind. But anyway, it was on the Outer Banks. Oh, it's the Knights of Rodan. Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Sorry, Richard, if you're listening, I haven't seen that film.
Okay.
But it's very, so you're right on the coast then.
Yes, part of the state is along the coast, and then there are mountains, and it's a beautiful state.
Yeah. Isn't that where I was going to say the Royal Navy, but that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Isn't that where the Royal Navy is based? That would really, really show how old I am. Isn't that where the American Navy is based, in North Carolina somewhere?
I don't know about the Navy, but there's an Army. There's an Army base. So, yeah.
Ah, got you. Grace, well, listen, thanks for joining us today, and our apologies for not knowing my Carolinas. But before we go further into the main podcast, that's right, Elaine, I've got five pertinent questions for you.
Okay.
Let's see how you go. Question number one, fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
I would invite Phoebe Palmer, the mother of the Wesleyan Holiness Movement, the 19th century Wesleyan Holiness Movement. And I would invite her because I wrote a book about her theology, and I think she's been misunderstood. And I think she was amazing.
Wow. Okay. Well, tell us more why she was misunderstood then, please.
Well, she was a layperson, and she started these things that she called Tuesday Meetings for the Promotion of Holiness, which is just a very 19th century name for something, right?
Yeah.
But she looked around and saw that the Methodist Church was becoming very socially acceptable and really not taking the gospel seriously enough. She became involved in praying a lot for her own soul to be fully given to God, fully sanctified. And she was the sort of person who just wasn't terribly emotional, and she couldn't work up tears or repentance the way she saw her friends doing. So she wrote out a legal contract. Okay, God, here we go. I'm making this contract. And she committed herself fully to God. And then days later had a mystical experience. And in writing about her, I've made the case that she was our own Methodist mystic. And her power, her reach of her ministry through the years as she got older was equal to any of the great Christian mystics, you know, Catherine of Siena or any of those people. And why I say she was misunderstood is that She was her theology, her spirituality were based upon trusting in God, whether your emotions are there or not. And of course, this came out of her own experience. She also had lost some of her children. They died. The third one that died in a tragic fire in the crib was just awful. And so I think she went through a dark night of the soul, classically understood. And so her writings are in line with some of the writings of other great Catholic saints who experienced a dark night. But because John Wesley was suspicious of that kind of spirituality and kind of discounted it in many of his writings, Methodists or Wesleyans did not have the theological framework for mystical or ascetical theology. And so she was misinterpreted and kind of sidelined by her people that followed her in the holiness movement. And it moved away from this really profound mystical theology and practice to actually kind of legalism, what holiness is legalism. Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, as you'll find out later on, or even now, I've got a brain of a simple brain, like Winnie the Pooh. And when you said Dark Knight, I immediately thought of, aha, Richard Gere. He was in a film called Black Knight, I think. So this could be a Richard Gere day. It could be.
He's a good actor.
Yes, he was in a film recently. I can't remember what it was. But just to clear something up then, because normally when we hear the word mystic, we go, oh, very New Age and stuff. And then you tagged on the word Christian mystic. So just put our mind at rest, because I honestly don't know. What to you is a mystic, please?
Sure. Well, I'll talk about a Christian mystic. Will that be helpful?
Well, don't mind either. I'm in a good mood today.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I wrote about it in my book, The Mystic Way of Evangelism. So there's that, if anybody wants to take a look at that book.
Publication house, please?
It's Baker Academic. Baker Academic, the revised second edition would be the one to get if you wanted to read that. And I define a Christian mystic as someone who is so transformed by their encounter with God, their living encounter with the living God, that they become a conduit for God's transformational work, not only in the church, but in the world. And so, in other words, they have that kind of relationship with God. And the test of a true Christian mystic, in my estimation, is the fruit of real holiness, the fruit of love. That this is someone whose life is a life of incredible love. I mean, think of Mother Teresa or Martin Luther King Jr. We could name lots of different people. These were people who definitely were mystics and definitely were prophetic, and definitely their lives continue past their death, continue to shape the world in good ways.
Mm. Great. Thank you for that. And I think we've just about exhausted question one as well now. So it's great. It's great to know. And no doubt they'll come later on again this afternoon, this interview. Stroke. Conversation. Question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, Elaine?
I think the parable of the treasure hidden in the field.
Oh, yeah.
And that has spoken to me for a very long time because God is, because of the humility of God, that God is our great treasure, right? The knowing Christ is the great treasure. And God is hidden in the ordinariness of life and is always there to be discovered. Sometimes we think that the Christian life or the spiritual life, walking with God requires these dramatic experiences, mountaintop events, sort of supernova things. But actually, the most of it is a treasure hidden in a field, ordinariness kind of thing, this beautiful divine life hidden in the ordinariness of life. Mm-hmm. And I really love that.
Lovely answer. Thank you. Question three. If you were prime minister for the day or the president of the United States for the day, you can choose on that one, and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be, please, Lane?
This would be president of the U.S. since I'm an American citizen. I would get rid of, actually, can I have two? Because I would get rid of.
I mean, as I told you, I'm in a good mood. Go for it.
All right. I would get rid of the filibuster.
Oh, yes.
And I would get rid of the Electoral College, because those are two systems that are used to exclude a lot of people from voting, to prevent good laws from being passed, contribute to a lot of shenanigans that should not happen. So those would be the ones. Yeah.
As you can tell by my accent, I'm not American.
Yes.
Filibustering. Nor are you.
You're not Australian either.
No, I'm not Australian either. Very good. Filibustering, I can't remember the last time we had a filibuster in the Houses of Parliament, but that, if I remember right, is when someone knows that they've only got 5 minutes left, and so they keep talking past the 5 minutes and just keep talking, which means that the next bill cannot be discussed because the bloke's still talking. That's filibustering, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I got that. But Electoral College, now that's something new. What? Explain to us Brits what an Electoral College is, please.
That's beyond my pay grade to get into all the details of that. But what it ends up being, the bottom line of the Electoral College is that when you cast your vote, you're not directly voting for the person. The Electoral College system is how people are finally elected to office. This is the Electoral College is why, for example, Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, and yet he was elected to office because of the Electoral College.
Ah, now that could be a bit like where we in the UK, we have constituencies. So you might have a constituency of like 300,000 people. The next constituency might be smaller, but might have a million people living in there. And it's all done by constituencies. As if you win that constituency, you've got that vote. So that's probably what it's like then, I would have thought.
Yeah, something along those lines. But it's not really democratic.
Yeah, that's a big talking point over here. But they think, yeah, let's move on. We do so well.
Okay.
Yes. Otherwise, you'd be filibustering and not even get to question four. Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out, please, Elaine?
Oh, wow. I think one of the most enjoyable ones, I went to see the Blue Man Group one time.
Oh, yeah.
It was so wonderful. It was just so wonderful. It was a very interesting performance, but they were able to cultivate the sense of community in this big stadium full of people. There was a sense of community there, you know, interacting with the audience and everything. It was just great.
Yeah, I don't think they ever made it over here as such. We'd heard of it. Am I right to say they're men all dressed up in blue?
Yes, and then they play like PVC pipes. They've got these weird things, instruments that they play.
Wow.
It's very percussive. Yeah.
Great stuff. Question five. What's been your most embarrassing moment to date, please, Elaine?
I have so many to choose from. It's hard. But there is one that goes, I was trying to think. This is when I was like, I don't know, 16, maybe 17. So I had a job at this local hamburger joint, little diner. And at the time, I was kind of horse crazy. Like, I really loved horses. I wanted to have a horse. You know, like a lot of girls are. And so there I am. I'm mopping the floor or making a hamburger or something. And this is in New Mexico, kind of a rural environment. And so this customer comes in and says to me, "Did you see that big horse out there? I wonder what kind of horse that is." And I looked out, and there, sure enough, there was this big horse with an unusual looking head. And of course, I took this moment to engage in what the Irish would call a bit of blarney. So I started explaining about what breed of horse. I don't know. I just made up something and tell him all about this horse, what it is, and kind of the features of this horse. And then this other guy walks into the diner and he says, "Did you see that mule out there? It's huge." it was a mule. And then the first guy looked at me like I was an idiot, because I was.
Please tell me there are people thinking it made an ass out of you and me there.
That's right.
Or is it just my, I said I got brains.
That's great.
But yeah. That's great stuff though. Thank you. I'll remember that should I ever meet you and talk to you about mules versus horses in the future.
Okay.
Listen, thank you very much indeed. That, you know, we get a better picture of who you are. And I must admit, I've been looking forward to this podcast for ages. So thank you for being with us today.
Sure.
Where should we start first of all? Because obviously I want to know what an abbess is. But before we do, though, I just say right at the very beginning that, you know, you've had a very unhappy childhood, for want of a better word, and you had to leave your home as a junior. Tell us more, please, if you don't mind.
Sure. And I wrote about this. My sister and I wrote a memoir together. It's called Loving the Hell Out of Ourselves, a memoir. Mm-hmm. She's a therapist. And of course, you know what I do for a living now. And so we grew up in a family in poverty with our father had multiple addictions, and our mother worked full time but didn't earn very much money because nurses didn't have labor unions in those days. And We were constantly moving around. So there were five of us kids in our family, and we suffered from many forms of violence, abuse, neglect, and poverty. All of us got kicked out of the home when we were kids, just kind of one after another, because of my father's challenges, his issues. And it wasn't because we were bad kids. We were all pretty good kids, actually. Yeah. And so we just had to go find our own way. It's kind of a marvel that the police didn't catch up, or the children's services or something, you know, but they weren't as active as they are today with cases like this. So, yeah, so I had to leave home when I was 16. I was a junior in high school and find my way.
See, I'm glad you shared that, because, as you know, I'm talking about off-grid Christianity, and I'm sure there are plenty of people who are thinking, I still believe in God, but I just can't go back to church anymore. And so it's lovely that you can share that. Where was your faith at the time when you were thrown out at 16 years of age?
I actually had become a Christian right before I got thrown out. And that was one of the things that was a flashpoint with my father was just kind of enraged about. Right. So I had a really amazing conversion experience. It's too long to go into that story right now, but I really feel like Jesus saved my life. Mm-hmm. I've walked with Jesus ever since then. I've never looked back. That doesn't mean I've always gotten it right. I've made some really stupid mistakes in my life. And after I left home and I had to get married, my parents set up a situation where I was forced to get married and while I was still a kid. And it had nothing to do with pregnancy. I was not pregnant.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, it was in an abusive relationship and just a lot of really difficult things. But I really felt Jesus with me and calling me forward. So as time went by, through God's grace, through people who crossed my path, I started healing from all the trauma. It's been a long process. And when I was in my early 30s, I experienced a call to ministry. And I was in a Pentecostal church at the time. And there was a woman on staff at that church who mentored me. She was just incredible. And so my journey into ministry, to become an ordained person, to work in academia as a professor, preparing people for ministry, then as an administrator, being dean of Duke Divinity School, and developing all these creative ministries, new monastic communities, all the things I've done, all of that emerged out of my healing journey, healing from trauma.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible. And then that healing theme flows through everything that I do, because that's been my experience of God.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because you've got a book coming out in April called Trauma.
Yes.
We say trauma. How do you say it?
Trauma,
yeah. Trauma.
Just a little different.
Yeah, we're there. Trauma informed evangelism.
Yes.
And who's that aimed at, that book?
That's for people in the church. That's for seminary students. It's for pastors. It's for lay people who can't stand the E word.
Evangelism.
It's for people who've been harmed by the church but still love Jesus. So in that book, Charles Kaiser, my co-author, wrote most of the book. He was my doctoral student, and he's brilliant. He's just brilliant. And after he finished his doctoral project, I said, this really needs to be published as soon as possible.
Yeah.
So we went to Erdmann's, and they were happy to publish it right away. And so it's in three sections. And what it is, Charles writes three chapters, and then I write a response chapter to these three sections. And it's just an amazing book of really holding the church accountable for the ways the church traumatizes people, and offering a vision for how can we not only stop traumatizing people, but how can we heal religious trauma. And it's informed by the latest neuroscience. It's informed by really excellent theological reflection and biblical interpretation. Yeah.
I'm fascinated by the subject. Our first ever episode number one is with Peter Mockford, who is one of the highest psychotherapists in the UK. You won't mind me saying that. And a former vicar as well. So it's interesting that you can be a Christian and a therapist. I know other faiths do it as well. But therapy got such a bad name for itself. Certainly in the UK, it's only been about the past 20 years where it's okay to say you go to therapy. Why has there been such a turnaround for the positive for people to go to therapy now?
That's an excellent question. I read this book by Anne Taves called Fits, Trances, and Visions. And it's about the history of religious experience from the Wesleys to William James. And it's about, part of the book is about how psychotherapy became a field, like behavioral science became a field. And she makes the case that it became a way to explain religious experience without religion. So these sort of, that was kind of the genesis of what became modern psychotherapy or psychotherapeutic fields. So within that study, she unpacks how originally things like what we would call today PTSD, or what we would, you know, some things that we know what they are now, those were attributed to hysteria, which and to other things, insanity. And those were all linked to race and gender. They were all linked to women and to minorities. There was this sort of racialization and misogyny involved in all of it. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I'm giving you such a long-winded answer, I think one of the biggest reasons why now in the church we can even talk about, oh, mental health, let's take care of our mental health. And a pastor can stand up and give a sermon and refer to his or her therapist, and it's okay. Nobody says, oh, my, you know, this person's nuts. Why did we hire them or whatever? I think a big reason why that's true is that we now have women and women's voices and women's perspectives in theology, in seminary, in biblical studies, and not only women, but people of color, minority voices, minority experiences shaping our theological vision. And so some of the inherent biases that we inherited against therapy or against taking seriously our mental health, it's something everybody needs to do. It's not for sort of so-called crazy people. It's for everybody. I really think a big reason why those are open for discussion now is because of the presence of women and historically minoritized people in the conversation.
Mentioned the word theologian, and that is your good self at Duke University.
That would be me, yeah.
Yeah, you can't get much higher than being the top bod at Duke, which you were before you decided to retire. I have a question, therefore, because I've been flying the flag for quite a few years now on a TV program that was made in the UK on the Channel 4 network. The great thing is it's actually available on YouTube. And it's a whole hour and a bit long documentary. Two ladies whose names are forgotten, unfortunately, they go to Israel and beyond because they want to show that Jesus's first disciples included women, and they'd been airbrushed out of the Bible. And they tried to give some clues, and it just blew my mind so much so that I had to watch it again a couple of years ago. So I'll put it to you then, true or false, women were airbrushed out of the Bible?
Yes, true.
Because
the people that got to say what's in and out and how we interpret it were men, particularly in our Western world, it's white Eurocentric men.
So
it's a patriarchal environment. That's why.
Yeah, but I think we have to get into context as well as to what it was like then, don't we? To the degree.
Oh no, women are in the Bible. What's remarkable is how is the counter narrative within the Bible. That's the part that hasn't been lifted up. So, for example, you have Junia is a woman. She's in there and she's been kind of interpreted out by a patriarchal interpretation. You have, you know, the daughters of Philip who were all prophets. They were prophesying, you know. Mm-hmm. I could list a lot of different people. So those, even the fact that, you know, the first witness to the resurrection was a woman. It was Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
And the men didn't want to believe her. And then Jesus had to chew them out about that once he saw them post-resurrection. So there are lots of stories there with women. I mean, Deborah in the book of Judges, she's the one godly judge. Deborah is.
Yeah. And it's also the fact that, you know, women, I can't remember, you'll be able to help me out here. One of the verses, but basically women were there to sort of look after the finances to a degree, get the food ready and things like that. But, you know, they also were like spearheading to make sure everything worked well. Am I right?
Well, you've got a lot of different cultures in the Bible, many different cultures. The Bible was written over, you know, well over 1,000 years in different contexts, you know, so you can't kind of describe it as one context. Mm-hmm. But women had plenty of responsibility. I mean, in the New Testament, you have Lydia, who's a businesswoman.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
She's a businesswoman. She's in the Roman context, right? Mm-hmm. And Roman women enjoyed more freedoms than some other women did. But yeah, if we can just approach the Bible with some understanding of the ancient cultures, read it in those contexts, we will see how oftentimes, particularly in the New Testament, it's really dramatically in favor of women's equality. That's what's gotten airbrushed out because it didn't serve the purposes of the people in charge.
Yeah, I think that's what the program is trying to mention as well. So Paul, or, you know, as in St. Paul, previously Saul, do you think he gets too much of a bad press, as if he's...
Yeah, because Paul traveled with women and served with them and was, you know... We've taken things that Paul wrote to Timothy, for example, that were culturally bound, you know, bound for a particular time and place because of a situation. They were situational. And we've made those in the church to like universal standards, which it doesn't make any sense at all. Anyway, I recommend Christians for Biblical Equality International as a resource that has a high view of scripture and is very experienced and wise with working toward helping the church practice equity between women and men and to interpret the Bible appropriately around gender.
Brilliant. Thank you for that very much indeed. Abbess, then, I presume, of which you are, is the female equivalent of an abbot.
Yes.
Tell me more what an abbess is supposed to do, please, then, Elaine.
Yeah. So they are traditionally the spiritual and administrative leaders of monastic communities. And here at Spring Forest, where I live, and where we have an intentional community, a new monastic community with a farm and with a whole range of ministries that we do, I'm the leader of our community. I'm the administrative and spiritual leader of our community. Part of what's happening here at Spring Forest, we are United Methodists, although people participate in Spring Forest from all sorts of backgrounds, including can't stand religion background.
Yeah.
So part of what we're doing is modeling or pioneering what new monasticism might look like for United Methodists, because it's not been a part of our tradition to have monastic communities.
Yes.
And this, in my view, is part of the way forward for the church to also have monastic expressions. Particularly as the church, I really feel like the church broadly, like the church universal, is entering into a new reformation that's enormous. It's just very dramatic. We're at the front end of one of those. And so monastic expressions, a new type of monasticism, is part of what the Holy Spirit is calling forth. So we're doing this as Methodists in order to kind of figure out how to do this and be faithful to our Wesleyan heritage and also be faithful to the new thing that God is doing.
Which leads on as part of Methodism, because I know we've talked about John Wesley, and so many people, when asked who their Christian hero is, and I'll be asking you later on as well, choose John Wesley. But you've mentioned United Methodists. So what's the difference between a United Methodist and I was going to say bog standard Methodist. You know what I mean, though, wasn't it? Help me out.
Or an untied Methodist. When you have a typo, it comes out untied Methodist.
Yes, yes.
Well, you know, that's a great question because Methodists, whether it's the British Methodist Church or the Methodist Church of Kenya or United Methodist, we all trace our heritage back to John Wesley, and actually to Susanna Wesley. She was the sort of genesis of all this, right? Mm. But the polity, how the polity works, the political structure of the denomination is different. So this is something about Methodism that I've thought is weird from the time I've been a Methodist for a really long time. But in the U.S., Methodism began during... Well, before the American Revolution, before the American Revolution, Wesley came over and so on. The structures that have developed for governance of the United Methodist Church parallel the structures of the U.S. government. It's like there's a judiciary, there's almost like a House of Representatives, and you know, it's kind of got that same structure to it, which is different from how things are done, like the Methodist Church of Britain, for example. And there are a bunch of, I won't get into the weeds about all that, but that's been the thing about American, U.S. American Methodism that's been striking to me, that it's kind of paralleled the development of the U.S. government.
So basically, when it comes to theology, and if you had the top board of the United Methodists sitting down for a cup of coffee with the top board of the ordinary Methodists, you know, they'd get on really well. There'd be no major problems.
Yeah, I think that's true. There's also quite a breadth, or at least there has been right now. You know, we're going through a split over sexuality in the U.S. American United Methodist Church. But in terms of just understanding what is grace and what does salvation mean, and, you know, just sort of basic Wesleyan theology, we would have some common ground. But there has been, it's been a big tent until very recently, so that you might be a very conservative or charismatic type Methodist and be a UM person, or you might be a very progressive, you know, you're really focused a lot on Black Lives Matter and, you know, social justice movements. And you could be a United Methodist and you could be across this broad spectrum. We're polarized now and we have these disaffiliations that are happening.
So
that's changed. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. So we've now established not only you're an abbess, but you are a United Methodist or an untied Methodist.
Untied Methodist.
we better explain that. Yeah, you left the eye out of. That's great. So you're one of those. Then you rose to the very top of Duke University. Tell us more what happened next and how we then got to for you to form your own monastery, really. Tell us more, please.
I went to school, went to college, went to seminary while I was raising my children, and joined the United Methodist Church toward the end of my seminary experience. I had been in a Pentecostal church prior to that. And I joined the United Methodist Church because I found more openness to me as a woman pursuing my call. I didn't run into the gender barriers that I was running into in my previous setting. So I knew I was called to not only be ordained as a pastor and to have a pastoral aspect to my ministry, but also I knew I was called to do academic ministry, to prepare people for ministry, and I knew I was called to some larger thing where I would be speaking to the church at large. That was a bit vague at the time I experienced call, but I knew, so I had those three pieces to my call. So I was appointed to my first Methodist appointment right out of seminary. I had three little churches in rural Ohio. And after I started serving those churches, I began my PhD work at Duquesne University in Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, so that I could also answer the call to academia. And so I completed my PhD. And during my last couple of years of like writing my dissertation and all those things, I resumed pastoral leadership full time. And then I was invited to a job right out of my PhD program. I started my first academic job. And then I had an opportunity to go to Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. I was recruited to the position of the McCreeless Professor of Evangelism. And that's like I don't have a PhD in practical theology or in evangelism. My PhD is in systematic theology, which is this is a completely different field. But for different reasons, people thought I would be a good choice for that role because I approach evangelism not as a sales job or scaring people out of hell or something or scaring the hell out of people, but rather I approach it through contemplative spirituality and social and environmental justice, like bringing these things together. Mm-hmm. And I approach the work of the evangelist as being like a good spiritual director who companions people, companions communities. And so I just had a very different take on it. I started teaching and started my writing projects. The Mystic Way of Evangelism was my first book that I wrote that really focused on evangelism. And it became kind of a template for all the research and work I would do that, you know, after that. Yeah. I realized shortly after I started teaching at Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist that my students were coming and crying in my office week after week and saying, Dr. Heath, I think I'm going to have to leave the church to answer the call because the church doesn't understand what I'm called to do. And as I listened to them, it was because they were being called to get beyond the stuck places of institutional church and actually embody the gospel in local neighborhoods, especially where there's suffering, mm-hmm. because they were learning these things from the way I focused it in the class. So I realized I needed to not only further focus my research and writing in the area of emerging forms of faith community, the collapse of institutional church, all that stuff that I've worked on, but I also shortly, you know, within a year and a half of starting that position, I realized I need to invite some of these students to create alternative communities of faith right here in the city as a laboratory so they can learn how to do this on the job. So I did. I started some communities with them. A bit risky, you know, I didn't have tenure yet, so I don't know if I'm supposed to write, you know, publish or perish. But God was with us, and soon a businessman joined what I was doing. He was a student at Perkins, and I met him on my way to my first pilgrimage to Iona, actually. Mm-hmm. I took some students to Iona. And we formed the Missional Wisdom Foundation to be an umbrella for these experimental communities. And within 3 years, we had 8 new monastic communities. My house became a mother house for the communities. And 2 and sometimes 3 missional house churches that were located in really dense apartment complex neighborhoods where they sent refugees to live when they came over. So that's how I got involved doing all the street work.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then out of all that, it's a long story, but I began getting invitations to speak around the world, actually, to talk about this, what God is doing now. And so the third part of my call, or that I had discerned during the call experience of speaking to the church at large, was then starting to happen. And I began writing more and more about this kind of theology and practice. So I'd been at Perkins for 10 years when I was recruited to come to Duke Divinity School to serve as dean. I ended up working 11 years at Perkins and then coming to Duke. And they were especially interested in having me come to this day, being the president and provost, wanted me to guide the school in a new direction with a new strategic plan that took seriously the emerging future of the church, since the Divinity School prepares leaders for the church of the future, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a very different future than what we've had in the past. And then the second thing they wanted me to focus on was a culture of equity and diversity and hospitality around race, gender, and sexuality for the school. So that's why I was recruited to come to Duke. And I came and served as dean for a couple of years, and then I took a sabbatical and retired so we could develop the ministries of Spring Forest and another nonprofit I had started called Neighborhood Seminary.
Gotcha. Honestly, I'm not trying to be confrontational here at all. But
okay if you are. I can.
No, I couldn't do it. I would be terrible at it. I'd be so mortified than everybody else. But it reminds me back in the early 80s when we started to get the house church movement going in the UK. There was a Church of England vicar called David Watson, and he tried to do it, and you know, to great success. We've also got the other side of the coin, where there was the Jesus Army in a farm, and that started off really well, but obviously, as you might be aware, went horribly wrong. So what checks and balances have you put in to make sure that, you know, nothing untoward happens as far as legal cases are concerned, giving bad theology, all that sort of stuff?
Well, I am under appointment here by the bishop of the North Carolina Conference of the United Methodist Church. So I'm appointed as the elder leading our community. We're a new faith community, and I'm accountable to, you know, the district superintendent and to the cabinet and to the bishop, and there are all kinds of reports we have to give and things like that, just like any other church would be, any other new faith community. It's really important for new monastic communities to stay connected to the larger body, you know, whether it's Methodist or something else, because the role of monastic communities historically has been to speak into the institutional church with vision and hope and with a prophetic witness. You can't do that if you cut yourself off and go off into the, I always think about going off into the desert outside of Waco and building a compound, you know, David Koresh. So you know, that's not the thing to do. But I also would challenge you back, you know, what are we doing in the traditional institutional church to prevent people from being harmed, from being sexually abused, from being shamed and humiliated for their gender or their whatever it is about that. You know, we're not doing a good job in the institutional church. So the sort of assumption that, oh, a new monastic community is fraught with danger that's not there in the traditional structures of church is just not true. No.
Basically, if you do it properly and use common sense and wisdom, as you say, align yourself with somebody in the church who's higher up and can look after you, that there shouldn't be any problem. Or should there? I mean, if I saw you one day and I was saying, oh, I really fancy coming to join your monastic church, sounds brilliant. What have I got to do in order to convince you that I am your person to join?
Well, we're crazily hospitable here. Like, we just welcome everybody. We welcome everybody. That's why we've got people at Spring Forest who are, you know, there's just a small number of us who live on the farm with two houses and three families. But there are several hundred people that are a part of Spring Forest one way or another, you know, through our farming endeavors or working with refugees or whatever we do. So we welcome everybody. People who want to, as people want to make a deeper commitment to ministry here, one of the things we ask is that they follow our rule of life in their daily lives. Mm-hmm. So and a rule of life is the traditional name for a common set of spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. So for Spring Forest, the common practices are prayer, work, table, and neighbor. And under each of those umbrellas, there's a set of expectations, right? And so we have it built into how we live, how we do our work as a community of faith, how we relate to our neighbors, how we make decisions about what we're going to focus on, what we're not going to focus on, and so on. Actually, our rule of life captures our strategic intent for the community. And we don't really believe in strategic planning. We believe in strategic intent, which is journey oriented, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were really, you know, you were coming to volunteer on the farm and then you started coming to our worship gatherings once a month and then you wanted to join in on morning prayer with us, you know, these are some things that people do. And then you, you know, you came and had a conversation with me and said, I just feel really alive here. This feels like my people. How can I become more committed? And I would say, well, you know, Martin, we have this rule of life. Let's talk about how you can live the rule of life. And if you, you know, wanted to, we have something called oblates, which is also part of traditional monastic communities, where people who live far away, who are not vowed members of the community, can follow their practices, their way of life. So we have a group of oblates who meet once a month on Zoom and talk about how life is going according to living that rule of life. And they help each other keep showing up, right? Which is a very Wesleyan practice. It's like the early class meetings of the Methodists. And then our oblates also have an annual pilgrimage to Spring Forest to come for a festival with prayer and teaching and music and recreation and being together. So, yeah, those are some ways.
Well, it all depends, really, first of all. What time is your prayer meeting in the morning?
It's at 8 a.m. Eastern time. So you could tune in at, what is it, 1 p.m. your time.
Yeah, it'd be 1 p.m. So, yeah, I could do that. That's all right.
Yeah, and we have it at 8 p.m. our time, too. It's 8 a.m., 8 p.m.
Yeah, 1 o'clock.
Be like 2 in the morning or something. Yeah. 1 o'clock in the morning.
But in all seriousness, how did you decide? What did you have to do to say, right, I'm really going to go for this now, but if this is what God's called me to do, I want to get a farm, I want to get people who want to come and join. What process did you have to do?
It was a gradual living into the vision. So actually, my husband and I had bought a piece of property more than 20 years ago, mm-hmm. when I went to my first academic job and wanted to develop something like this. You know, we were looking to the future when I would retire, and we thought, well, we'll just gradually do this. Because I, at that time, I did spiritual direction with quite a number of clergy and had retreats and things like that. And so we had bought this property. And then when we saw God was leading us to go to Texas for me to teach there, we had to sell that property. And I sensed God saying to me in prayer, that's a sacred dream. Don't give it up. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen in the future on a much better piece of property and in a much better time in your life for that to happen. So hold on to it. It's going to happen. So, you know, years went by. And when we were getting ready to move to North Carolina, I said to my husband, Randall, this is the time for that dream to start unfolding. So let's look for a rural property. And so we did. And we found this property, and it's indeed much better than that first property. And it's a much better time in our lives and for all sorts of reasons. Mm-hmm. So I retired earlier from Duke than I had originally intended, but it seemed very clear to me that it was time to retire and to do this, to develop Spring Forest and to also this other nonprofit that I had started, to get it up and running and hand it off to capable hands.
Did he say it's 20 years now in the making?
Yes. And in those interim years when we were in Texas, you'll remember I mentioned that we started those new monastic communities. See, all of that was part of getting to where we are now.
Mm-hmm. Now, that ties in very nicely, actually, with someone I haven't seen for years. I must get hold of him again, saying that his experience was that God looks at what you've gone through the past 20 years to see as like the basis of what he wants you to do next. So, you know, you had 20 years in the making for what you're doing now, which is brilliant. A bugbear of mine, or a flag-bearing thing of mine, I think, flag-bearing, is the difference between discipleship and evangelism. And I just get the feeling too often we're so focused in on getting people saved that we miss the thing about discipleship, because it's one thing to be saved, but it's that, to me, that like you're now your first lamppost, and God wants you to move you along to several lampposts ahead to get to where he wants you to be now. What's your feeling on that?
I think it's a false dichotomy. Here's my definition of evangelism. It's the initiation of people into the reign of God revealed in Jesus Christ, empowered by the Holy Spirit, for the transformation of the world. Evangelism is anchored in the community, which is God's people. And so it's this initiation into a way of life. And it's not, for me, it's not like, okay, yesterday I was a lousy sinner, today I said the right words, now I'm all different and I love Jesus and everything before me was bad and this is good. So that sort of binary thinking is really not the way life happens. Mm. It's not the way the spiritual journey happens.
Mm.
One of the pieces of wisdom we can gain from the Benedictine spiritual tradition is mm-hmm. this idea that we are in community so that every day we can be converted again. Being converted is every day because we live together and our stuff surfaces, issues. And so every day we have a chance to then grow in our experience of Christ and in our experience of being loved and of being a loving person. So, so there's, and the other thing about discipleship, if I could just say this,
please,
is I know that in my years as a United Methodist and in the years before that, as a Christian in the Pentecostal church, so often discipleship seemed to be equated with showing up at the church building at the appointed hours, putting money in the plate, singing in the choir, being on a committee, maybe teaching a Sunday school class, not robbing the bank. It was this sort of things that were oriented around the church building and church programs. And it was never oriented around, as far as I could tell, actually healing the wounds in your own neighborhood.
Yes.
It wasn't like that. There was this whole dimension of life that seemed to be left out. So I really believe discipleship is much more robust. Like peacemaking should be part of our expectation for disciples.
Yes.
You know, the ability to work through conflict in a healthy way and to speak across lines of division with love and grace, to be there. I mean, love of enemy is the basis of the gospel, right? That's the centerpiece of the gospel, love of enemy. And if we can't learn to do that love and justice work and the peace work,
yeah,
are we really disciples?
Yeah. Yeah. I used to be a training officer years and years ago and loved every minute of it. And one of the things we had to train on was conflict resolution, which mm-hmm. I think for in the business world, it's out there. But quite often in the Christian world, it's not. It's like, no, I'm going to sweep it under the carpet. And I'm going, no, mm-hmm. let's talk about it. Come on. I've obviously upset you because I'm very good at that. let's talk about it. No, everything's fine, you know. And it's not. So what stories can you tell on that, do you think?
About peace and reconciliation
work.
I need to be cautious about what I, when other people's lives and situations are involved.
Yeah.
But I can tell you this about Spring Forest. So Spring Forest, one of our main ministries is we support refugee resettlement.
Mm-hmm.
So we work with World Relief. We not only sponsor refugee families, help to set up their apartments, make sure that they settle in as well as we can support them, getting used to the new environment and really building real friendships. But we also have a English as a second language program.
Okay.
So so we have quite a large number of people that come into that program and we help people learn to speak English so they can get jobs and all those things. We also have social events so that people are not so isolated, especially the moms, kind of stuck in the apartment. So the vast majority of the people that we have served in the last couple of years are Muslim. Mm-hmm. And I mean, some of them are really devout Muslims. Some of them are just sort of cultural Muslims. But we assume that God is with these neighbors that have come to us from really difficult experiences in refugee camps. Mm-hmm. And having lost homes and loved ones in war, for example, in Afghanistan. So we don't try to force them to become Christians. We try to be better Christians by loving and welcoming them. We're trying to work on our own discipleship, right?
Yeah.
So being people of peace, people of hospitality, people of welcome, supporting, believing that Christ is coming to us through these neighbors. Jesus said, whatever you've done to the least of these, you've done to him.
Yeah.
And so we take that really literally. So we try to practice peaceful healing, ministry of presence and support to these new neighbors.
Wow. Wow. Fantastic. Your book is coming out in April. That's April 2023. That's this year. Trauma-informed evangelism. The book amplifies the voices of those who suffered misogynistic, racist or homophobic abuse at the hands of the church. And for those that are listening today, Elaine, and can identify with one or all of these abuses, mm-hmm. apart from buying the book, what would you say to them?
I would say that any abuse that you've experienced in the name of Jesus is wrong. It's wrong. And on behalf of the church, I just want to express my deepest sorrow that it happened to you. I've experienced that kind of harm myself. Mm. I know how painful it is. And that's not who Jesus is. That's not what the gospel is really about. That's the opposite of what the gospel is about and who Jesus is. That God is for you and not against you. I also want to say you can heal from this kind of spiritual trauma. And as we heal from it, God's presence in our lives becomes very powerful and rich. And we become wounded healers for other people.
Yeah, lovely. And this expression that we've heard quite a few times from other guests here on Off Grid Christianity, that it's all summed up by dying to self. What does that mean to you?
It means two things. There's the sense of dying to being driven by our ego, you know, where what I want is kind of king of the hill, you know, like I get to make all the choices and it's all about me. It's sort of narcissism, dying to sort of narcissism. But it's much more than that. Excuse me.
Sorry.
I want to say it was Basil Pennington, but it might have been somebody else that has written about true self and false self. Thomas Merton wrote about true self and false self. Henry Nouwen wrote about it. And so it might have been Richard Rohr. So what if... Not Richard Gere, no. All the Richards, right, yeah. dying to self is also about dying to the false self so that true self can live. And the false self is that persona we develop in order to get by in life. And it is connected to trauma we've had in some ways.
When you say false self, is that when we put a barriers in front of us? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's about it's all about what I can do, what I can achieve, and the persona I need to be so that I can make it.
Yeah, I understand.
I wish we had more time to delve into it. There's just not enough time, I do recommend reading True Self, False Self by Basil Pennington. And then Richard Rohr has also written some interesting things about it, and so has Henry Nouwen. But our true self is our self in Christ. Mm-hmm. And that's the self that, you know, in Revelation where it says that Christ gives us a white stone and our name is written on it, and it's this precious name that Jesus himself gives each one of us. It's an unrepeatable name, like it's a unique name. That's our true self. Like that's a symbol for true self.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Apostle Paul writes in one of the epistles, it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And that's the true self. This true self is myself as God created me in union with Christ, who is absolute love, and living in harmony with Christ. So dying to false self is dying to this sort of persona, I'll use that persona,
yeah, yeah,
that's dependent upon my efforts alone and what I've had to do to heal, not only not to heal necessarily, but just to cope,
yeah,
you know? I often think about this process of coming home to ourselves, our true self, mm-hmm. It's being like Adam and Eve after the fall, you know, everything that happens after the fall. It's like before the fall, they were naked and unashamed. They could just be themselves and there was no shame.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Living from the true self is like a no shame zone. We're naked and unashamed before God and ourselves again. and we can be free to be who we are and who we were meant to be.
Yes, yes. Yes. Whereas full self is like, I suppose in some ways, keeping yourself so busy and trying to do so many things for God, you know, like you might even become a vicar or a priest or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's your full self, maybe.
Well, it can be. I mean, it can manifest that way, you know, a workaholic. It can also manifest as like the tough guy, the tough girl, you know, that just kind of, you know, like these types that Clint Eastwood plays in these movies. You know? I mean, it can manifest in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
But if you just think about it's springing not from a sense of holism or and being God's beloved or anything like that, but it's springing from I've got to take care of myself because nobody else will, and protecting myself and projecting what I want people to think I am and this sort of carefully constructed persona. And everybody does it. Nobody is exempt from, because we live in a fallen world, a broken world, and this is what we do to get by. But Christ, so dying to self is not about losing your humanity or not being you anymore. It's actually about coming home to your true self and being freed from the sort of drivenness of, and all of that from the false self.
Well, in 10 seconds, if you can answer it, for those that are listening today saying, no, I really get that. How do they start the process of dying to self then?
Paradoxically, by coming into an experience of your belovedness to God. Mm-hmm. It's all about entering into this relationship where you allow God to really love you and you believe it. So that's the contemplative life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as the more we go into experiencing ourselves as God's beloved, the more we heal from toxic shame that any kind of violence or abuse has put into us, a trauma, the more that we die to that old driven, however it has constructed itself in our lives, we die to that. And we become free and alive and able to love well and able to be present, able to be full of grace toward ourselves and toward other people, because the grace is what we're receiving from the God who loves us, who's there for us.
Yeah. Elaine, wow, fantastic answers. You know, and I said, you know, we end up in a place that I maybe not thought we'd go. Thank you so much. And one final question. It is the final question, you'd be pleased to know. I'm going to go, I think you're going to choose somebody with the surname Wesley. Who is your Christian hero? Why have you chosen that person? And of course, the person has to be dead and a Christian. So who, Elaine Heath, is your Christian hero, please?
Her name was Betty Jevons, Elizabeth Jevons. And she is the woman who mentored me from the time I was 29 until, I don't know, she passed away in 2007, so for some decades.
Yeah.
And she was a true Christian mystic, and I would not be who I am today without her profound spiritual friendship.
Well, tell us more in the 2 minutes, please, as to who she was. And this fantastic, I love it when it's personal. Go on.
Yeah, she was so wonderful. She was Canadian. Her family had immigrated to Canada from Ukraine when she was two. They fled for their lives when Stalin was doing what he did. Mm-hmm. And so she grew up around Saskatchewan, I believe, in this Mennonite family, farmers. When I met her, she was on staff at London Gospel Temple, which was a Pentecostal Assemblies of Canada church in London, Ontario. I lived there for a while. And I had never met anyone like her. She was, here was this woman. I mean, I had never seen women pastors. I had been in a very restrictive environment religiously. And she was on the staff, and she was probably in her mid-50s at the time that I met her. She was very beautiful. Her spirit radiated. She was almost translucent with the presence of Christ. And she was compassionate. She had great wisdom. She was an incredible Bible teacher. The thing, though, that really, when I met her, I was going through a really hard time. And she saw me, like she saw my heart. and she deeply respected me and honored me, she started asking me to just kind of shadow her. I didn't know what was going on. I thought, why does she want to be with me? It's like, it's just me, you know, because I hadn't really started much into my own healing journey yet. I still had a lot of shame and just a lot of hurt from the violence I'd experienced. Yeah. And so I would just go with her. I was raising my kids, so my kids would be at school, and then I would go with her to make pastoral visits to sick people and dying people. And she would say to me, why don't you come in my office? I'm going to lead a retreat. I just want to run my ideas by you. And I'm like, why would you run them by me? I don't know anything, you know? Yeah, yeah. And so what she was doing was stacking the deck so I could hear a call to ministry. She could see it. So after I had known her for 3 years and she had been doing these things with me and had handed over a Bible study group to me and everything, I had this really profound call experience. And so I was quite undone by it. And it was like, it lasted 2 weeks, this call experience. So I finally went to talk to her about it. And I was very nervous. My lips were sticking to my teeth, you know, and my mouth was dry and could hardly make eye contact with her, you know, because I admired her. So I'm sort of haltingly telling her, I believe I'm being called by God. And she starts to laugh, which really surprised me because she was generally kind of a sober person, you know, she wasn't given giggling, for example. She starts to laugh and she laughs really hard and wipes the little tears out of her eyes from laughing. She said, oh, Elaine, I saw it the day I met you. I saw it and I went home and wrote about it. I wrote it in my journal. And she said, you're not going to believe where God's going to take you. She said, I've seen it. And it almost made me a little jealous, but I'm not jealous. And then it's just like Yoda or something. She just gave me these sort of bullet points of what to do and to not do. And she said, never seek the limelight. She said, go where God leads you. If the door is closed, don't try to push it open. She said, God will always give you some kind of a John the Baptist to prepare the way. So go where you're welcome. Don't try to push your way in if you're not welcome. Never make your ministry about getting money or any of those things. She said, those things ruin people. She said, always say yes to God, and God will always open the way for you and will always take care of your children. You don't need to worry about that. Always say yes to God. And I promised her that I would do that.
Wow. Yeah. And her name again, please, is?
Betty Jevons, J-E-A-V-O-N-S.
Wow. Sounds as if you need to write a book about her.
Yes, do.
Well, off you go then. when you write the book, you can answer the question, who am I? Am I Yoda, Princess Leia, or Obi-Wan Kenobi? There you go. And let me know. Elaine Heath, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real privilege, and I mean that. I've loved listening to you, and I hope we can meet up again and hear more of your wise words. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank Blessings.
You. Cheers. God bless.